Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, sitting in, Steve Linder. A little later in the podcast, we were able to talk with Kirsten Gillibrand on her bus. We had a little shaky audio on that interview, but we'll kind of lead in some questions, and you can hear her answers just fine. And some very interesting answers to questions about how she sees herself breaking through and how Michigan is a vital part of her strategy to be relevant in the Democratic presidential race. Steve, we had you in here to talk about a couple subjects that you're very excited about, redistricting and marijuana regulation. And John, why don't you get started with a question here on redistricting?
All right, Steve, let's talk about, we now have voters, not politicians, in place. We now have the Supreme Court saying the courts have no business telling states how to redistrict. What issues do you see coming up on the horizon as we implement this new plan that the voters adopted?
Number one, the Supreme Court got it right. You know, we're a nation of 50 states, and it's the states are constitutionally given the right to draw lines for state legislature or other offices, and also their own congressional lines as long as they meet the criteria, you know, laid out for lines for members of Congress, which is basically zero deviation. That's really the only criteria. The problems I see are in the following order. First of all, there's a constitutional problem, I believe, with the law that was adopted on the ballot. It basically excludes, by association, certain groups of people. My mother could not serve on the redistricting commission because I happen to have chosen to be in politics. And so my mother, my sister, my sons, nobody. That's un-American. Anybody should have the right to serve on any public commission. I'm surprised no one has challenged that yet. And basically, they've set up a commission that, in my opinion, is about as effective as a jury. You know, you go through voir dire and you eliminate all the people that are smart, that know anything about what's being talked about, and you end up with the lowest, you know, common denominator. I have no doubt the people that are going to serve on it are doing it in earnest and that they believe that they're doing a public good. But redistricting is about statistics. It's about standard deviation. It's about understanding the laws that are already in place. We talked a little earlier about the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. Do they know anything about it? How are they going? If you're going to start with the Voting Rights Act as the centerpiece of any redistricting plan, then you normally would start with the city of Detroit. How do you not face challenge by trying to create, quote unquote, more equity, if you will, in the statistical outcome of elections? The only way you would be able to do that is to diminish minority representation, African-American representation. I don't think if I were, you know, leader of the Black Caucus, the Detroit Caucus, or any other minority group, that I would be real happy about the fact that Detroit might be busted up, you know, to create some sort of a utopian outcome.
No, there's no other way other than, I guess, splitting or fracturing the city of Detroit. There's no other way to do it.
No, there's no other. Look, if the goal is to create 110, exactly 50% district, first of all, what is a 50% district? I started out as a Democrat years ago. I'm not anymore. Haven't been in a really long time. You know, people change their minds. There's a belief that people's political beliefs are etched in stone, and you can statistically and through polling and micro targeting and data mining figure out exactly where somebody's going to come down, you know, on an issue and a candidate on the ballot. It's just not possible. There are very reliable predictors. There's hundreds of predictors of voting behavior. The three most reliable still to this day are race, abortion, and how often you practice religion, in other words, attend worship. Those are by far the most reliable predictors. After that, it's a mishmash of, you know, how somebody is going to come down and vote. People argue, well, you know, there's, you know, the states, you know, the gentleman that was here, the states, you know, 60% Democrat. Well, how do you know that? You know, you don't know that. And by the way, if people that tend to think a certain way congregate in a certain area, then you're going to get a higher percentage of those folks in those particular districts. you know, to me, I think that it's arrogant to say that we need you over here to even things out. And people move, mm-hmm. right? Grand Rapids isn't what it used to be. Oakland County isn't what it used to be. The fact that Dems won 5 seats in the state Senate and they won, 5 or 6 seats in the state House, to me, diminished the argument that you needed this voters, not politician. People move, their political mm-hmm. attitudes change and drift. They're just going to be setting themselves up for another, you know, set of problems, probably another set of circumstances. And in states where they've done this, the outcome hasn't really been marginally any different.
Mm-hmm. As voters, not politicians, gets prepared to have this take effect after the 2020 census, name the top 3 ways you think this could be legally challenged.
Well, as I said, number 1 on the Voting Rights Act. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge is reducing minority representation. And the way that the Voting Rights Act has been interpreted is African American. There are other minorities, but in the case of the Voting Rights Act, it's that. The second is carving up cities, townships, and counties, and blowing them into different districts. So you not only get away from compactness, you get away from, you know, homogenous units of government. So those are 2 areas. If a city or a county is going to lose money because of the way their districts are divided, I guarantee you they're probably going to go to court.
Do you think the legislature at some point sues the commission over this whole thing? Is that a possibility?
Well, when you say the legislature, I don't think that there's any unity of position on voters, not politicians. Look, we have elections. We elect officials. I like people that are accountable, serving in office, performing the task of drawing new lines in public. People forget hundreds of maps were submitted to the reapportionment committees of both the House and the Senate. There were hearings on them. And there were votes on them, and they're publicly recorded votes. Now we've taken what was an open, transparent system, and we've basically given it to a group of people that nobody knows. Nobody knows what their qualifications are. Nobody knows who influences them. Are they going to have to file personal financial statements so that we can see if anybody maybe has paid somebody off, you know, to push a particular position, you know, or not? And what is going to be the demographic, you know, makeup of this group in the end? Who influences that? This committee is fraught with issues.
Would you be anticipating for 2022? Are we going to end up with maps that, because of court cases and so on, just are not that much different than what would have been drawn otherwise? Are we going to end up with maps that are just a different version of somebody else's gerrymandering? How do you think this is going to actually play out?
Well, first of all, again, I really hate the term gerrymander. It is a made-up, pejorative term by somebody centuries ago. It's called reapportionment. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but if you look at what's happened in other states, the outcome, as I said, has not materially been very different. So we're going to go through this entire exercise possibly for no different outcome. We won't know, of course, until November of 2022, the way that it's going to work out. But quite frankly, I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, some sort of legal challenges to the maps that are written.
Steve, another thing that you're interested in here is the marijuana industry. Give us an update from your perspective on how the medical market is kind of shaping up. Give me an idea of kind of what the problems are right now and if we're kind of resolving them at this point.
Well, the biggest problem, and I'd like to, if I could, just digress a minute. You know, I didn't care about pot. I was asked to, you know, get involved because of my issue management experience. I don't know if ultimately this having, you know, a regulated, you know, access to marijuana is a good or bad thing. I'm really, you know, ecumenical about it. We had a bad system that was passed in 2008. It was a system that had no regulation at all. Every dispensary that was open between 2008 and when we passed the Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act was illegal. The Supreme Court said it was illegal. The Attorney General said it was illegal. But for some reason, we just couldn't muster the courage to get law enforcement to shut down these dispensaries. Any person that had a medical card prior to September of 2016 was supposed to be buying their product from a caregiver. And it wasn't tested, okay? So I understand that there are medicinal qualities and that there are people that have found relief. There is no other drug that you can buy that isn't tested, certified by the FDA, or if it's a supplement by, you know, USP, and sold in a legitimate outlet or by a regulated pharmacist. And yet here we were selling this untested product with mold and pesticides and metals in it as medical cures. I had a trial lawyer when we were looking at challenging, you know, the department on allowing the temporary operators to stay open. He said, I know somebody's died. I'm just going to have to find them, you know? So, which is what trial lawyers do, right? But what's been encouraging is, first of all, we have probably one of the best regulators I've ever met running the department now. Andrew Brisbo is really a very competent, first-rate regulator. And the department were caught in a little bit of a vice. Something materialized that really changed the argument, and that was the argument about access. Now, you won't find access in any of the laws, not the 2008 law or the 2016 law. Both laws were to legalize and then regulate. Access is a completely separate issue. And who's to determine how much product is enough product? And so, you know, the department basically gave a, you know, kind of a Solomon's solution to it, and that is we're going to try and push people towards, you know, the regulated marketplace, but if patients can't get their product, in which, by the way, they're supposed to get them from caregivers, we're going to allow temporary operators to stay open, but they're going to have to comply with the law and get their product tested and sell it through licensed growers and processors. It's very tough. It's a lot of enforcement. So, you know, in my opinion, you're either in or you're out. Mm-hmm. But it looks like right now the department is doing a pretty good job getting us to where we're going to have a totally regulated marketplace where patients under the medical law are going to have the confidence that the product that they get is tested, safe, legal to use. Its efficacy, well, I don't know. I can't testify to that.
One of the prevailing things we've heard as the market has come up is that patient access issue. People out there were concerned about it, but in recent months, there's been concern from the folks that are licensed and in the business that they can't compete with, you know, kind of the temporary operators that are still going.
You mean illegal operators?
Yeah. And so since the department has kind of tried to kind of close the door on that, and we've seen kind of some movement from the governor to restructure the agency. Are conditions, I guess, getting more favorable for folks in the business? Have we seen some improvements in that area?
From the regulatory standpoint, things are getting better because the department is really stepping in. The problem that we're facing right now is for years, a lot of product flowed into Michigan from other states. I've seen it. I've seen bales of pot that had tags from California and Oregon. And they find their way here. Caregivers, you know, still, you know, are growing, you know, more than the number of patients that they're allowed to service. Just today in the newspaper, there was an article about how in California, still two-thirds of the marketplace is illegal. The difficulty here is trying to ramp up enforcement to the point where it's very tough for illegal operators and anybody else to sell product that is not grown and distributed through the regulated system to do so. That's, you know, strictly an enforcement challenge that we have right now. Look, you've got guys right now that are investing tens of millions of dollars in these facilities. And now that we've got a marketplace up and running, the only way that the economics of the marketplace are going to be able to work is if everything is within the regulated system. Mm-hmm. So it really is incumbent upon the department and law enforcement to drive out all of the illegal product and all of the unregulated activity.
Isn't that, though, something you can't even accomplish? I mean, if you can grow plants in your own home for your personal use, how do you control that?
Well, I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? You know, there may need to be an amendment, for instance, of the adult use law, which has a home grow, you know, component to it. In California right now, you've got into poor neighborhoods buying up houses for next to nothing and doing home grow, right? And then just taking the product and moving on to the next house and the next house. If you're going to have a regulated system, everything has got to be in it. You have folks out there who don't want any regulation, who think, you know, plants are plants and we ought to be able to grow the plants and use the product. But we have a regulated system right now. And as long as we have a regulated system, it needs to be enforced, because we have people that now have invested real money, have hired real people that are making their livings off of the industry. So we really can't go backwards. We're either in a regulated system or we're not, and we're just going to have to keep pressing the legislature and the department to keep moving into the direction where at some point soon every marijuana product that's distributed is distributed based on whether or not it came from a licensed grower, licensed processor, transporter, lab, in provisioning center.
Now, there is another drug that was illegal for a while and has been legal for a long time, and that's alcohol. Mm-hmm. And of course, I do see the difference between it's a lot easier to grow a plant right. than it is to have a still, and yet we were able to outlaw stills. Do you see this in any way ultimately following the same pattern we had with alcohol?
I hope so. You know, we did get rid of the stills. To me, again, the biggest problem with adult use is not that there's going to be adult use. People spoke and said they wanted it. The issue is, can we diminish or eliminate the product that is not in the regulated system? Home grow right now allows you to grow for your own personal use. And if you give it to somebody else, you need to give it away. Let's just be real. That is not going to happen. It hasn't happened that way anywhere else. Why would we think that the people of Michigan are going to conduct themselves any differently? We need to have a fully regulated system, just like alcohol, just like tobacco.
So would you argue that, you know, as the market grows, both on the adult use side and the medical side, that it might be in a public policy interest to move away from the home grow market and even the caregiver model?
Well, I'm going to not speak to the caregiver model, but the home grow model, in my opinion, we need to move away from. But it is the law right now. It allows home grow. Unless there's a change in the law by 3/4 vote of the legislature, we're going to have to figure out a way to live with it.
Any other concerns you have with the current regulatory structure?
No concerns, really. It's just, you know, we're starting to pick up the curve in terms of getting licensed entities up and running right now. I know there's been, you know, some complaints about still, you know, lack of product, but the product comes. It's a plant. It has to grow. It has to be processed and has to be tested before it gets. So we're probably in a, you know, maybe a year period of transition right now as product starts to flow into the retail sector. But I think the department is doing a very good job of starting to pick up the pace and get more people in the business. The biggest problem we have is, and it's not really a problem necessarily, it's a situation where a lot of local governments still don't want this activity in their communities. And there are a lot of communities that want, we gave them that authority. We gave them the power to decide if you want to have facilities in your community or not. And under medical, what type of facilities mm-hmm. you can have. And so really the pressure has been on the provisioning centers, getting them approved at the local level.
So are we going to be seeing things, maybe we already have, I don't know enough about this, where that medical place is just on the other side of the city limits?
I guess I'm not quite understanding.
Okay, you know, we're going to get into this thing where the typical place that has the medical is just outside of a city limit, where it's in a different a township or something that isn't opposed to it.
Well, people have to opt in for medical. They have to opt out for adult use, and hundreds of communities have opted out. A lot of them opted out until they saw the rules from the state under which they can sort of regulate and control the number of facilities in their communities. I don't see in the short term every part of the state being equally represented, if you will, with marijuana businesses. But right now, I think the department issued a statement that said everybody in Michigan lives within 30 minutes, you know, of a facility. And I think that's that time is going to get shortened as we roll out more facilities. But you have to have an ordinance in order to have a facility in your town.
Well, thanks for coming in, Steve. We appreciate you being a guest today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Just imagine how much cooler I'll be in summer. The hot and the cold are both so intense. Put them together, it just makes sense.
We're now going to move into our interview with Kirsten Gillibrand. This was on the campaign bus on Friday on her way from Oakland to Flint. There's a bit of background noise on this one. We apologize in advance for that, but please enjoy the comments on it. Okay, we're live on the Kirsten Gillibrand bus tour of the state of Michigan. We're going from Oakland County to Flint, and she's joining us now on our podcast. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Delighted.
Senator, I wanted to go back to the Stephen Colbert Show when you announced your exploratory committee to run for president. And he gave you a plane ticket to Michigan part of his booby prize or whatever it was. Have you used it yet?
Yes. So our first trip in the campaign for a town hall was to Michigan. And we were able to do a town hall with MSNBC. And it was a huge opportunity to begin to have a conversation with Michiganders about the issues they care about. Right now, we are on the Trump Broken Promises bus tour. We're going to Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan to really lay out all the promises President Trump made that he's already broken. Bad trade deals. He promised lower prescription drug prices. He promised ending gun violence, and he's done none of it. And so I'm talking about my vision for America and why I'd be a better president and why I'm the best person to defeat Trump.
Now, Senator, during that interview, the insinuation is that the Democratic nominee in 2016 didn't campaign in Michigan enough. Well, what's your assessment of what happened there?
You know, there's a lot of assessments, but the truth is Hillary got 65 million cracks in that highest and hardest glass ceiling, and she won the popular vote. So, but I know we are at a moment in this country where people are desperate to be heard, that they feel deeply left behind by the economy, and they feel like no one's fighting for them. And so I want to show up to the places in this country where people want someone to fight for them and their families so they have a chance at the American dream. And that's why I'm in Michigan, because I will earn Michigan's vote along with Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and be the next president.
And kind of to that point, Michigan's primary is not until March 10th, so it's kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of the primary schedule goes. And some might argue, well, why wouldn't she be in Iowa or New Hampshire trying to generate more enthusiasm? Because March 10 rolls around, and you may not still be on the stage.
Yes, but every Democrat I've met across the country in Iowa and New Hampshire, their number one criteria for the next presidential candidate to take on Trump is someone who can beat him. They want to know that someone can reach out to red and purple places in this country and actually win. And that's who I am. My first House district was in a 2-1 Republican district. I won it twice, second time with a 24-point margin, running on progressive issues. I ran on getting the troops out of Iraq. I ran on Medicare for All in 2005. And so I know that I can connect with voters here in Michigan, and I want to show the American people by showing up that exactly how I'm going to beat Trump.
Now, the Democratic primary, it seems like that the movement is going a bit more to the left. And I want to get your assessment on this. Is there a concern that if the Democratic Party goes too far to the left, that it could alienate states like Michigan, and they could go toward Trump?
I think the most important thing for our nominee to show is that they actually bring people together, that they actually have a history of getting things done, passing bipartisan legislation, winning in red and purple places in their communities. That's what we need for the next president. We need a healer. We need somebody who will bring us together, not divide us further. And that's who I am, and that's why I'm running for president.
And in talking about these particular issues, and I'm thinking more about universal health care and the Green New Deal in particular, how do you tell folks that you're with them, but you're not with them all the way? Appealing to an independent?
I think the way I talk about issues is appealing to everyone, to Democrats, independents, and Republicans. For example, on Medicare for All, I think people should be able to buy in at a price they can afford, a percentage of income, maybe 4 or 5%. It would be matched by their employer, and that's how you fund it. and that would create competition with the insurance industry. And I don't think the insurance industry would compete, because they never do. They never lower their prices. They always raise their prices. They always want to make money. They don't want to actually protect their patients. And so when you have an option of getting Medicare at such a lower rate, that covers more things, and you can improve Medicare. You can make sure it actually covers dental and vision and hearing. You can actually make sure the reimbursement rates of hospitals and doctor's offices is accurate and actually is the cost of what service is being provided. And if you take on the drug companies and you guarantee that they get the lowest price for drugs for Medicare patients, that's how you build Medicare for all. And if I can explain that to anyone anywhere, they like it, because they like competition, and they think a not-for-profit provider wouldn't have to spend so much money on CEO pay and quarterly profit and shareholder value. They know that all that money would be going towards their health care.
Now, Mayor Pete agreed with you in the last debate on that. Do you think you're bringing full support on this?
I sure am, and I've been leading the conversation not just on Medicare for all and how to get there, but leading the conversation on women's reproductive choice, leading the conversation on getting money out of politics and how we restore our democracy and fix our democracy first through publicly funded elections. I'm leading the conversation on national public service as a way to get to debt-free college for our young people. And so I'm really proud of our campaign, and I believe that just in the beginning, with time, I will be able to be the nominee.
I do mention during our last stop here in Oakland County that you are Catholic. How much of a rub is pro-choice stance with your Catholic religion? Do you find a conflict at all?
I don't. I think that...
Talk about that.
Yeah, so I believe in God, and I am a Christian, and I practice the Catholic Church. But my faith believes in free will, and my faith believes that you can only come to God if you come yourself. You can't be forced. You can't be brought there. You have to come yourself. And that's the gift of faith and the gift of grace. So I don't think you can impose your faith on other people. And our Constitution says there's a separation of church and state, and that we are guaranteed that you can believe whatever you want or not believe whatever you want. And when you impose your religious views on others, that violates not only your faith, but our Constitution. And so I believe women's right to reproductive freedom is their own right. And we know for 40 years it's been a constitutional right, a right to privacy. It's guaranteed to every woman, every transgender woman, any person who needs reproductive care. And those fundamental decisions about when to have children, how many to have, and under what circumstances should only rest with the woman. No government, no conservative legislature in any of the 30 states that are trying to overturn Roe v. Wade should be allowed to make that decision for women.
Are you among the folks who think that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned by this one?
I do. I believe that's why President Trump nominated Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, and that's why 30 legislatures have been so emboldened. They are literally trying to pass laws that criminalize abortion and criminalize the caregivers who provide it with 99-year sentences. And so their intention is to get that law up to the Supreme Court so they can either validate it or not. And they believe that they have a path to overturning Roe v. Wade.
Now, the last time you were in Michigan, you had the Governor Gretchen Whitmer here, and you mentioned her on the Colbert Show also. Talk about your relationship with our governor, and if you hope that you might be able to get her endorsement at some point.
I do. I think she's amazing. I think she's a role model for everyone. The fact that she ran in a state won by Trump, won it by 10 points, running on the issue of the health care as a right and not a privilege. She's someone who has led, and I think she's a role model for me and for any other person, woman running for president right now, because she showed how to win a purple state, a state that Trump had won, and that's why I'm campaigning here, because she is such a good role model, and I do hope to earn her endorsement.
Did you follow the flap between the president and the U.S. soccer team?
I did.
Yeah, what did you think of their decision about visiting the White House with Trump?
I would make the very same decision.
Would you really?
Yes, I would. Under this presidency.
It's a White House, though. You can see the White House.
There's another White House after this one.
Well, that's a way to look at it there. I wanted to ask you about the Green Party as well. Where are you on that? And is some of the folks in your party a little too far left on this one?
No, and the truth is, it's really bipartisan. The Green New Deal is three major things. Infrastructure, couldn't pick something more bipartisan than that. New electric grids, rural broadband, more mass transit, high-speed rail, things Michigan wants and everyone wants. Green jobs. Everybody wants to train our young kids in science and technology and engineering and math. Everyone wants opportunities to part of a high-tech future of innovation and entrepreneurialism in green technology. And so it's a job generator and a huge opportunity for Michigan. And third, clean air, clean water. There's not a state that doesn't have polluted water. We're on our way to Flint right now. They still have lead in their water. They're not guaranteed clean water. They still haven't had the resources they need to fix their pipe systems as well as their personal appliances in their homes, whether it's faucets or water heaters. So communities who have been left behind who don't have access to clean water are really struggling. You add to it the PFOA and PFAS and other chemicals from military bases as well as legacy manufacturing, and you have common ground. And so these are three issues I've been working on for a decade. They're all bipartisan. That's all the Green New Deal is. The only part that's not bipartisan is the goal of net zero carbon emissions in 10 years. But to me, there's nothing different about that than when John F. Kennedy said, I want to put a man on the moon in 10 years. He had no clue he could get it done, but he knew it would be a great organizing principle to get every engineer and mathematician in the country to want to be part of it. And he didn't just do it alone. He created a space race with Russia to create international competition and drive. You can do the same thing with green energy. Not only sign back on to the Global Climate Accords, but how about a green energy race with China? How about creating opportunity for a worldwide conversation about who's going to innovate the best, the fastest for wind and solar and geothermal? That's exciting. And I think the president can use the bully pulpit to actually drive that inspiration to get more young people and more entrepreneurs to focus on this one problem.
I'm kind of bouncing around between politics and policy here, but while I still have it on my mind, I wanted to ask you about Justin Amash. Have you been following him, our congressman here in Michigan?
He's now an independent, right?
He's now an independent, yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, I was grateful that he was willing to stand up to Trump, and it just highlighted the fact that most of the Republican Party does not have a backbone and is unwilling to stand up to President Trump because they are so, beholden to the power that they have. And they want power at all costs, even if it means not protecting our democracy.
What's your feeling on how Nancy Pelosi is the speaker? I know it's a different chamber and whatnot, but it's kind of the same person. What do you think she's been doing?
I think she's been doing great. And I like the fact that she's put through a really robust agenda for the first few months. The first set of ideas was about fixing our democracy, getting money out of politics, publicly funded elections, ethics reform, stopping the revolving door between electeds and lobbyists, trying to clean up government, because it really went off the rails under Republican leadership. So I love the fact that she's focused on voting rights and making sure everyone has the right to vote and have access to the ballot and shoring up the next election. So I think she's doing a strong job, and I'm grateful that she is really focused on our agenda for the country.
Are you feeling the same type of energy from the 2018 campaign as this one? It's very early in 2020.
I am.
Are you?
I do. I think that you've seen the town hall we just had. It was full. Women in particular are still on fire. They're still angry about President Trump. They're concerned about their reproductive rights being stolen and taken away. They want a better economy for their families. They want us to deal with these life and death issues of clean water, global climate change, gun violence. And they're going to fight for it. And I think that's why I'm the best candidate to beat Trump, because I think the women's vote is going to be instrumental in the next election.
You've already guaranteed yourself a position on the stage.
On the July debate stage. I will be in Detroit, which I'm so excited about.
Why is that? You don't hear a lot of people say, yeah, I'm excited about going to Detroit.
Oh, I am. It's heartland. Absolutely. And so many of the issues where I differ on President Trump are right here. You know, his constant focus and saying he's for no bad trade deals. Well, he just locked in a bad trade deal with Mexico, guaranteeing pharmaceutical companies can have record profits. He has a trade war with China right now, which is really destabilizing the economies for our farmers, for our producers, for dairy and for soybeans. China's big purchasers of those, as well as our manufacturing. So President Trump's trade wars really hurt Michiganders.
Is that the big message that you want folks to take away from your talk during the debate? The trade wars, is that the big message?
You don't get to pick which questions you get at, but I get to talk about the economy and trade, because the truth is President Trump is a liar, and he's really destabilizing our economy and our place in the world.
Two nights
again, and 10 and 10, so I don't know what night I'll have, and I don't know who's on my stage, but I'm really excited to be in Michigan.
One last thing I wanted to ask about Tom Steyer. What do you think of him getting into the race? I mean, because he's kind of the antithesis.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to John, Steve Linder for coming in, Jacob Kanzler, and Jack Spencer. Also, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullin. Take care.